Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing? I mean, nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and welcome to Dave the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Program, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grief process. You know, with roughly 100 million caregivers in the U.S. and Canada alone, that's about a third of the population. That means that everyone probably knows someone caring for a loved one. Join Dave and his guests now and every Wednesday at noon Pacific time as they discuss avoiding caregiver burnout and surviving grief. So find a comfortable place to relax, kick up your feet, and prepare to feel better and to receive practical tips and tools that you can start using immediately to get you through today and every day so you can survive your tomorrows. But not just survive, but to live life fully and abundantly. Yes, you heard me right. That is a possible goal to achieve. And now, here's your host, Dave Nassani. From Los Angeles, a big LA welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I'm Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, coming to you live globally through the many global platforms we have, including iTunes and YouTube and Stitcher and Blog Talk Radio and Mixcloud and Listen Notes and Blueberry. And we just found one the other day, and I forgot the name of it, but I'll get back to you on that. And iTunes, of course, where all our recorded podcasts and videocasts are saved for your later on-demand listening pleasure, including, of course, our website, caregiverscaregiver.com, or a shorter one we have now that works is caregiverdave.com. In fact, if you just Google caregiver and Dave, those are the only two words you need to find me all over the world. Isn't that amazing? Well, our goal here is to do our very best to help you avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout, and we have an exciting show planned for you today. First of all, with my lovely backup co-host, Linda Bice, who is looking like $1 million today. Say hello, Linda.
Thank you very much, Dave. Hi, everyone.
And today we'll be interviewing author Paul Wallace, all the way from London, England, and it's probably about 9 p.m. tonight, so we're keeping him up. And he wrote a book, can you believe it, for the blind, talking about what no one else is talking about, macular degeneration. You will not want to miss this show. I'm your host, Dave Nassani, and this show is to caregivers of every single kind. And the one thing we know about caregivers is that they're caring, selfless, sacrificial souls, and they have this tiny little problem. They're very prone to burnout because they tend to put their needs at the bottom of the list. And everyone else's needs are more important than theirs, and that's why, you know, they burn out. That's why 30% of them actually die before their loved ones do, and 60% become hospitalized, needing a caregiver of their own eventually. Now, those are just shocking statistics, and we have to stop this, okay? So if you're doing that, stop it. Now, we can learn something from the airlines. Yes, even United. They tell us in the event of an emergency, put your own oxygen mask on first before you attempt to help your loved one with their mask. Hello, what an amazing metaphor for all of life. Take care of you first, not out of selfishness, but out of survival. And we also talk about grief and loss here because anyone who goes through a loss experiences grief. You know, if you lose your girlfriend, if you lose your keys, if you lose your husband, your wife, that's a little more serious, of course, but you get what I'm saying. And there is a grief process, and sometimes it could take days or weeks or months or years. And you know what? Some people are never getting over their grief, but I think that's unacceptable. So if you feel like you've been grieving long enough, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, and you're ready to move on, and we can help. And unfortunately, folks, there's only one way out of the grief process, and you got to go through it. There's no shortcuts, can't go around it, over it, under it. Got to go through it, and hopefully we can help you, like I said. And I want to take this opportunity and thank my last week's guests. We had two great guests on last week, Dave Nassani and Adrian Gruberg, because our other guests didn't make it, so we interviewed each other. And just a reminder, you can listen to that interview and all our interviews right on our website, caregiverscaregiver.com or caregiverdave.com. And all right, enough of that. Hey, a big welcome to my guest, Paul Wallace. Welcome to the show, Paul. I'm so excited to have you on all the way from the other side of the world.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be on the show.
It's so nice listening to your voice. You know, we all in the colonies used to sound like that, and I don't know what happened. Our language just got perverted, you know, kind of like the Cockneys of Great Britain. Now, I don't want to offend any Cockneys over there, so I apologize. But It's kind of interesting, the accents of the world, isn't it?
It is. I think actually, in some ways, Americans speak truer English than the English do. I think maybe our language diverted more than yours did.
You think so?
Yeah, I think it's quite possible. Yeah.
Interesting. That's interesting.
And you're sure you're talking about the Southerners?
Oh, yes, Southerners. Now, that's another story. Or the Brooklynites. Hey, Turdy Tree and Toyd, you talking to me?
I must admit, there are some English accents I can't understand, so I wouldn't worry about it.
Oh, and the Irish and the Scottish, I don't. That's tough. I don't know if you can understand a Scot.
Varies. Some are quite understandable and some are completely ununderstandable. You need subtitles in this country to understand them if they're really Glaswegian.
You have a Scottish name, Wallace, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of. It's Welsh, Scottish.
Who's that famous warrior who
William Wallace.
William Wallace. Any relation? Yeah, yeah. There must be.
Well, maybe, but I don't know. I don't think. I don't think so.
Well, I like to have all of our guests introduce themselves with something like, why was Paul Wallace put on this earth, and what have you got to share with us that's going to change the world, Paul?
Well, I trained in the UK as an optometrist. And when I was a child, I had a great aunt called Great Aunt Phil. And she was an absolutely formidable woman. You didn't argue with Great Aunt Phil. And she was a social worker. And she worked all the way through the Second World War in the Blitz in London. And she worked with blind deaf girls.
Wow.
And she always worked with the blind through that time. So as a child, I always knew about blind people and the work that went on there and the work that she had done. And she was honoured for her work that she'd done. So that was kind of a background to me. And then I went into optics, the world of vision. And my first job was in London, working at Moorfields Eye Hospital, which is the major eye hospital in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked in the low visual aid clinic there, which is for blind and partially sighted people. So I had a background, and actually working with blind and partially sighted people in my profession is only it's not a large part of the profession at all. It's a very niche bit of it.
No.
Most optometrists don't do very much work with blind and partially sighted. So I was a specialist from quite a beginning age. The interesting thing was that when I had been working there probably about a couple of years, one afternoon, a lady came in to see me, and it was her 90th birthday. And her vision was very poor. She had macular degeneration. And she wanted me to help her out. And because it was her 90th birthday, I think she'd got the idea that I was going to wave a magic wand that day. And so when I'd finished my work, she would be able to go home. She'd be able to read all her books. She'd be able to do all her cooking and shopping and everything that she wanted to do. And everything would be absolutely wonderful. So I did what I was meant to do as I'd been trained. And I concluded what I'd done. And basically, I failed. And I didn't actually manage to get her doing what she wanted to do. And there was one of those horrible silences happened at that particular point where both of us realized that actually I had failed miserably because of her vision problems. I couldn't actually do anything for her. She was a lovely lady. I mean, she was a classic grandma. You know, she was fairly tall and elegant, but she had a lovely sense of humor. And she was just a really nice person. But I had done absolutely nothing for her, and she thanked me very politely and went. And that experience sort of dented my confidence in what I was actually doing. And I thought, this isn't, you know, I thought, oh, that didn't really go very well, did it? You know, and I was like, oh, well, this isn't very good. And then over the next few years, over about the next sort of 5, 7 years,
We lost you a little bit there. Say that sentence over again.
I got increasingly disillusioned with the work that I was doing, because I felt that I wasn't really helping people. I was going through the motions of helping people, and they would say thank you very much and so on, and they would go away. And I just knew that it wasn't working. And I almost actually gave up doing... I almost gave up working with people who had lost vision, because I knew I wasn't helping. But I was forced by circumstances, because there were very few people in the area where I was now living who could do this work. So I thought, well, okay, I'll carry on doing it. Partly because I was so disillusioned with what I was doing, I just sort of thought, okay, well, I'm going to do something different. So I changed the way I worked. And it was by changing the way I worked that I realized what I should have been doing and I hadn't been doing, and what I hadn't been taught how to do. Yeah. And that's why I wrote the book, because I don't know how... I'm British. And I work in Britain, so I don't really understand the U.S. model, but I would imagine it's pretty it's pretty similar.
What's the name of your book?
The book is Macular Degeneration, A Guide to Help Someone You Love. The problem with the medical model is it's a diagnose and treat model. So therefore, if you have a problem, you go into the hospital or the doctor and you say, I can't do this or whatever it is. And he says, oh, I'll work out what's wrong with you. Oh, yes, you've got macular degeneration. And then we'll treat you. That's fine. That's what they're there for. They're not interested in the consequences of living with a disease process. So therefore, you're diagnosed with macular degeneration, and you may or you may not go blind. And if you do go blind, well, I'm terribly sorry you've gone blind. That's it. You know, goodbye.
What is their treatment, typically?
There are two types of macular degeneration. And putting it crudely, there's dry macular degeneration and wet macular degeneration. There really is no treatment for dry macular degeneration. Wet macular degeneration, you can have treatment by having injections into the eye. Now, if that, dry macular degeneration will just degenerate and you will lose vision eventually. It can take quite a long time. If you lose vision with wet macular degeneration, again, it can take some time, but you can hold on to the vision by doing the injections. The problem is that people are left stuck. They don't know what to do, and they are not given any hope. And that was the main thing that I did to write the book, because I realized I actually could give hope to people and that there was a way around the problem. Now, that leads me on to the kind of caring side of it, because the interesting thing about, again, the medical model is that when I worked in the hospital, the patient would come in with their problem, and somebody would have brought them along to the hospital. And as far as the hospital was concerned, that was all they were there for, to bring the person there and then to remove them at the end of it. Thank you very much. Goodbye. I don't really need to know who you are, why you're there or anything. You are just a transport system, effectively, for the carer. And you dealt with the patient. And for reasons of confidentiality and so on, you dealt with the patient. And again, when I changed the way I worked, what I realized was that actually the most important person in the room was, there were three of us. There was me, the practitioner, the patient who had macular degeneration, and then the third person was the carer who had bought them, which was generally a partner or a family member. And in fact, I concluded after a while, the most important person in the room was the third person, who was the carer. And they are virtually...
Or in America, we call them caregivers.
Caregivers, yeah. We have different words. But the caregiver is critical to looking after the person. And as you just said, you use the word caregiver, we use the word carer. The other thing about my book is that I don't those words have meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not particularly keen on the word caregiver or carer in the situation of macular degeneration, in actual fact, because caring implies that the situation is a kind of permanent situation, that, you know, the person needs care and they are going to continue needing care. Now, that is certainly the case in certain situations, you know, ailments and whatever that have happened. But with macular degeneration, I don't actually believe that it is a permanent state of disability.
Really? Do your colleagues agree with you?
It's a permanent state of disability in the sense of they have lost vision.
Uh-huh.
But I wouldn't say that the person is permanently handicapped by that condition. You can educate them and get them back to living a form of independent life. It will be different to what it was before they lost vision, undoubtedly. But with education and help and so on from a caregiver, but I would prefer to use the word coach.
Okay.
Because they can coach the person back to being able to be independent again. And that's a very important distinction.
So are you saying that when someone has macular degeneration, that they're kind of bypassing the regular blind protocol of people who maybe were born blind and were taught Braille and are taught how to use, you know, the white stick and taught how to listen and taught how to feel and vibrations and all of that stuff? Are they like ignored? Because it's like, oh, well, you're a Johnny come lately, and so, you know, it's probably too late for you to learn all this stuff. Is that kind of their attitude?
Yes, it is.
Sad.
It is, and it's an interesting thing, in actual fact, because there are two types of blind people. There are people who are born blind or lose sight very, very early in life, and then there are people who, with macular degeneration, most people don't lose vision until they're into their 70s, generally, or 80s. And it's terrible if you lost vision as a child, but in some ways I have less sympathy with them because that's they've never experienced anything else. So their world is a world without vision. And so
we think of the famous ones, Ray Charles, you know, Stevie Wonder, etc. I have a relative who is in their 80s or maybe even 90s, and she's been suffering with this for 10 years, and she's just going blinder and blinder. And, she doesn't do Braille. She doesn't have her little stick. It's like she's blind and not independent, and she needs a permanent caregiver. And, it's a very interesting concept. What do you think about that, Linda? Well, you know somebody who's actually getting injections, don't you?
Right. And, you know, who came to mind was Helen Keller. She was I idolized her when I was growing up and read everything about her I could. But, we've got a really good friend who's turning 80 next month, as a matter of fact. And he has been getting injections for 2 years now. I take him every 4 to 6 weeks. And it depends on how well the eye is doing. But he has lost complete sight in one eye, and they're trying now to save the other one. And it is the wet type. It's not the dry, so that was the good news. But
did he delay going to the doctor for that one eye that it actually went blind?
It was one of those things where they really didn't diagnose him or diagnose him properly, and then by the time they did, it was too late for that eye. I was born completely blind in my right eye, and then for 2 weeks when I was a teenager, I was completely blind. They had me all bandaged up because both eyes got damaged. But the good part was the blind eye that was already blind had the worst damage. So if I had not already been blind in that eye, I would be now. But that reminded me of my son always used to say, what does it feel like just to see out of one eye? So I got him a patch one day, and it lasted about an hour. He took it back off.
It's very interesting that people don't like only having one eye. They can only put up with it for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then they have to take the patch off. I always say to people, if you lose an eye because of an accident for whatever reason, it takes about 6 months to actually get used to the fact that you've only got one eye. And people aren't really very sympathetic to it because they think, well, you've got an eye.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What's the problem?
Big deal.
Yeah.
But it is very disorientating only having one eye. And it takes, as I said, about 6 months because you can't judge distances or speeds where anything is.
Yeah.
So even picking up a cup off a table, your hand goes into the wrong place.
That's right. And look, this is my son's desk. These don't work either for one eye.
Oh, right.
The what is it, 3D glasses? They're worthless.
Yeah. It's an interesting one because wet and dry macular degeneration are not two clearly defined entities. They merge from one to the other. It's a spectrum. So you can have dry macula, which turns into a wet macula, or you can have a wet macula that turns into a dry macula, or so what will happen is that you will, as an optometrist, I will look into an eye and think, that's interesting, that doesn't look quite right. Now the person may have perfectly good vision and you can look at it and you think, well, am I going to worry this person by saying, you've got macular degeneration, particularly if they've got dry macular degeneration, because you know that there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
So if there's nothing that you can do about it, I could frighten them stupid and say, oh, yes, you're going to go blind because you've got macular degeneration, which isn't particularly useful. And it's ethically interesting question, and it depends on a large extent as a practitioner how you decide to approach the person and how you think they are going to take that information, because you don't want to frighten them. On the other hand, some people want all the information and other people don't want any information. So you've got to kind of judge them and think, well, do I give you this information or don't I give you this information?
Can one eye be wet and one eye be dry? Is that possible?
Yeah, perfectly possible.
Oh,
yeah.
So maybe is the eye that...
I was about to say that might be the reason.
Interesting.
So the other problem is that people don't understand blindness. Now, I did ask you actually earlier if you've got a pair of glasses there. So could you put the glasses on that I asked you to put on to prepare?
I thought he was kidding with that British humor. You want to know if I had glasses and butter.
Right. This is
okay,
a little...
So I smeared butter all over my glasses.
Yeah. This is something that people can try at home. Because if a family member has got macular degeneration, it's very difficult to understand what they can and can't see. Because if you ask the average member of the population, what is blindness? They say, oh, I know what blindness is. I understand that exactly. It's perfectly easy.
I'm going to see what happens if I put this on my camera lens.
That's very good, actually. Yeah.
It's just really fuzzy and weird.
Yeah, exactly that. Because if you ask the member of the public what blindness is, they say, oh, yes, it's perfectly simple. If I close my eyes, I can't see anything. There's no light, there's no dark, nothing. I've got no vision. That is blindness, undoubtedly. But only 3% of people who are registered as blind have no vision whatsoever. 97% of people who are blind have the vision that you have now put in front of that camera, so that you would look at somebody, and now we're looking at Dave on the camera, and you can sort of see a face there, but you have no idea who it is.
Yeah, I wouldn't want that person driving.
No, you wouldn't. What happens is that the person with macular degeneration loses detail. And this is extremely confusing for the rest of the population, because a person with macular degeneration can walk around the streets perfectly happily. They can walk up and down the road. They can walk through a shopping mall. They won't walk into people. They can see where they're going. They're not going to fall over a seat or a bench. But they can't recognize who is around them. So they could walk past their husband or wife or child and not know they were there. Or if they walk into a shop, they can walk into a shop perfectly happily. They know the shop they want to walk into. They want to walk into Walmart. They walk into Walmart, and then they have absolutely no idea what is going on around them. They don't know what there's some colors and things like that. They can't make out whether they're bottles or packets or anything. So they can't pick out, they can't shop because there's no detail there. Mm-hmm. So that little exercise that you did is critical, really, for somebody who has a family member with macular degeneration to try and understand what actually happens. Because if you do that, then you think, oh, I see. Because if you put the glasses back on again and now try and operate your cell phone, you won't be able to do it. It's, you know, you look at the computer, you look at anything like that, you have no idea what you're looking at.
No, I can't read anything on here.
Exactly. So you can't operate a cell phone, you can't use a computer. All that detail has disappeared. So it's extremely confusing to people, the family, who don't understand what's happening around them. What is happening to this person? Why are they, you know, because they're wandering around okay, you know.
Yeah.
And the public don't understand it either.
So there's my phone.
Yep. And it's completely unintelligible. But there are iPhones that you can use if you have poor vision like that. Because the way that you normally use a phone, you want to dial somebody, you put your finger on the phone and press a button, and you go sort of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's the number.
Yeah.
There's a phone that you can use where you actually put your finger on the number and it'll go, it'll say to you 1. Oh. And you think, I don't actually want to press the number 1. So you can move your finger across to 2. And then when you remove the finger, it then dials 2. You put your finger back on the phone and you put it onto 6. You think, I don't want to dial 6. You move it across onto 7. When you remove your finger, it dials 7. So you can.
Where do you get these from?
On the internet, it's a sign app tick, SYNAPP.
Oh, it's an app. You can put it on your phone.
You can put it on a phone. You can't put it on an iPhone. You can put it on an Android phone. Yeah. You can put it on an Android one, but not an iPhone. But that is a way of using it, a phone thing. The other interesting technology is fascinating, actually, because the most useful piece of device that's ever come out in my whole career came out about 2 years ago. And that is actually the Amazon Echo. It's absolutely brilliant.
Echo, yes.
Because you talk to it. I mean, the thing is that the problem is that the person can't use a computer easily. You can use a computer. It's hard work, really, really hard work, though, if you've got poor vision. But with an Amazon Echo, you don't need to use the keyboard. You just say, Alexa, do this, Alexa, do that, and it'll do it. So it really is the most useful piece of kit that's ever come out in my career, as far as I'm concerned. It's fascinating, actually. And over the next 10 years, the Echo will be a really, really useful piece of kit.
Awesome. Well, listen, we're going to take a break, so don't go away. We will be right back.
Welcome, caregivers. Thank you so much for finding your way to our community of loving and supportive caregivers. We as caregivers understand and know the day-to-day feelings of guilt, fear, and loneliness. But guess what? There is hope. I, Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, along with my team of experts and caring caregivers, have made this site just for you. We are a community of caregivers that understands and supports you wherever you are in your journey. We are a place to connect with other caregivers, but more importantly, a place to get practical, actionable help. There are lots of ways for you to get support. First of all, you can download our welcome pack. This will get you started on your Thrive journey. Next, you can ask and get answers to your questions by posting them here in our private Facebook groups. You can also get live online support by attending one of our live weekly Connect webinars. You can get practical, actionable advice by listening to our weekly podcast. You can hear and read other stories about other caregivers' experiences, plus add your own in our weekly Share Your Story forum, posted every Tuesday in the Facebook group. You can access essential resources and download practical Thrive Solutions packs, all of which are geared to help you thrive as a caregiver. We know funds are tight, so we offer all of our individual Thrive Solutions packs at just $19 each. Or for even a better deal, you can get lifetime access to all of our resources for a one-time fee of $47.97. Again, we are here to support you and help you thrive and to enjoy your life as a caregiver. Before this video ends, download our free welcome pack below. And remember, this is a place to get hope, not just cope.
Welcome back. We're back with Linda Bice and Dave Nassani and our guest Paul Wallace, optometrist. Did I say that right?
Optometrist,
and then there's another opt-something, right?
Yeah.
You know, I had a problem with my eyes about 2 years ago, and I was seeing these flashes of light, you know? It was driving me crazy. So I went to the doctor, and he says, well, you need to see an optometrist. And so I went, and he says, well, you know, usually that happens when your retina starts detaching. And so he did an exam, and he said, not sure if it's just old age or a dry eye or something that happens that gives the illusion that your retina is detaching. And so he says, let's wait about a month and we'll see if they go away, then you're okay. And so I went back in a month and they had decreased. And he says, no, your retina is intact. So what is that all about? Flashes of light, where does that come from?
Very often.
As well?
Yeah, very often it's where the retina gets stretched at the back of the eyeball. The retina is the nerve fiber layer. It's like the film in an old-fashioned camera. It's about the size of a 35 millimeter film, in actual fact, and it lines the inside of the eyeball. And with some people, the retina is actually kind of smaller than the eyeball itself, so it then stretches across the back of the eyeball, and then it's like a piece of rubber almost. And where it's being pulled, it gets mechanically stimulated, and so it fires off, and you think, oh, I'm seeing something, like lights. If the worst came to the worst, it would actually go ping, and then that would be a detachment. So I suggest that you don't take up kickboxing, because getting kicked in the head would be a good way of detaching your retina.
Trauma to the head, that's what I was, and that was after my bicycle accident. So I said, oh my gosh, I had trauma, you know,
was it after the...
It was after my bicycle accident, yeah.
It may well have been tension on that happened and actually just knocked it slightly.
Jarred it a little, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad everything's good now.
Yeah.
So let's talk about insurance. I'm not sure, you know, everyone, when we were doing the debate on healthcare, everyone was saying, well, you know, Canada has a great system, or England has a great system, or Australia has a great system. But, you know, when somebody gets sick, they don't go to those places. They come to America. Is that because the quality of care really is better here? I mean, what's your opinion about that? And how does this affect macular degeneration in Great Britain and here in America?
It's an interesting one because going back to when I first qualified, there was no treatment for dry macular degeneration, and there was no treatment for wet macular degeneration in those days. So, in fact, there was no treatment at all for macular degeneration. But about 15 years ago, I suppose it was, the injections began to come through. And so you could then have the injection to the back of the eye. And that is the sort of standard treatment now for wet macular degeneration. And you need to be seen, it depends on the treatment regime, but maybe once a month, something like that, maybe once 6 weeks. And then that goes through like that. Now, in this country, we have the NHS. So you would just go to the hospital and be treated. It wouldn't cost you anything, and it'll just get treated. But the problem with it, one of the problems, and it must have happened in the States as well, is that... suddenly you had a whole cohort of people who had never needed any treatment whatsoever, and they suddenly needed to be treated once a month with an injection to the back of the eyeball, which is quite tricky. So the pressure on ophthalmologists suddenly became very intense, because these people previously were just seen once for in their whole career, but now they were being seen maybe 12 times a year, which is phenomenal, and a lot of them were being like that. So it suddenly meant that there was a lot of pressure on ophthalmology departments, and that would have been the same in the States as well. And also the cost involved, treatment for macular degeneration, the drugs for macular degeneration, I think are the sixth biggest drug bill in the state, in the UK.
Wilton says that his shots are $5,000 each.
Oh, come on.
Each. Every shot. But his insurance pays all of
it. I'm in the wrong business.
$5,000,
and that's the insurance rate, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's quite interesting. There's a lot of debate about that, because the in this country,
Lucentis, even the stuff that my wife needs for dry eye is very, very expensive. They're eye drops,
Well, Lucentis is what is used generally in the National Health Service, and I think, I'm not sure, but as a rough figure, it's about 700.
They were using Restasis, and then that was the only one, and now this other one came out that you mentioned. Competition.
Well, I'm not sure what the names are in the US, but in the UK we call it Lucentis. And they're about £750 a shot in this country. What is very interesting is that there's a drug called Avastin, which is actually only costing 50 quid a shot,
mm-hmm.
£50 a shot. But for bizarre reasons of things, which I'm not sure who's going to be watching this thing, for legal purposes, it's not used because it's never been licensed in the UK. But in fact, the results of using Avastin and Lucentis are very, very similar. There's a new drug called Eylea come out, and that's by Regeneron, I forgot the name of the company. But that's the newest drug that's come out, Eylea. And they're very expensive drugs. So it's interesting. The treatment for macular degeneration is going to change a lot over the next 10 years or so, because stem cell research is coming through. And when that happens, it could well be the case that there may well exactly be a cure for macular degeneration. There has never been a cure for macular degeneration previously. All that you're doing with the injections is holding the situation. You're not actually curing it. You're just stopping the condition getting worse.
What's the theory on this new medication that will reverse it? What's the theoretical? How does it happen?
What happens is that they take stem cells from you and grow them on a very tiny little net, effectively, which is about 4 millimeters by 6 millimeters, like a kind of mat. And then that mat of new cells will be injected into the back of the eye at the retina, and then they will regrow, and then they will regrow new macular cells. And so therefore you will grow new cells. The problem with dry macular degeneration is that what happens is that you and I are of a similar age. When you were a child, your mother would have darned your socks. Now, nobody darns socks. Now, the reason for that is that when you were a child, you had woolen socks, probably, and you could have a hole in a sock and you could darn across the hole because there was wool there. So you could darn and make a hole, and then you had a hole with a darned hole in it. Nowadays, socks are made of nylon. So what happens is that the nylon actually just withers away and just evaporates, so you can't darn across the hole. There's no hole, you can't do it. And that's effectively what happens with macular degeneration, that the retina, the macular area, just withers away, so there are no cells there, which is why you can't cure it, because there are no cells to cure, because they've just evaporated.
Stem cells are very interesting, because they're curing all sorts of things. Cancer, they're curing neck pain, cartilage regrowth. It's an amazing thing. There was such a debate against using stem cells, but I guess that debate's over, huh?
Yeah, I think so. I think you'd be very stupid to argue against it. I'm very excited by the potential of medicine over the next 20 years or so. It's going to be phenomenal. Unfortunately, I think I probably have died before they found a cure for whatever
I've
got.
Unless they can cure dementia and Alzheimer's, I don't want to live longer, you know?
Well, I don't know.
Quality of life is the thing here. How close are they to curing dementia, I wonder? I wonder if stem cells can fix that.
That one I have absolutely no idea about at all. I couldn't
help you on
that.
Getting out of your field now.
Yeah, definitely on that one. I would like to, going back to the caregiving angle and burnout with caregivers. In the book, I've sort of got information for people to try and work with them to give them a path, get the person back to independence. And effectively, what you were saying at the beginning of putting yourself first is very important. But what I would propose for somebody who has the situation where they have a family member with macular degeneration is they need to think carefully about who there is around them, because the best way of helping the person is actually to create a team. Because nobody has all the skill set that you need to help. And there are specific areas with macular degeneration where you do need help. I've mentioned, you know, mobile phones and the Amazon Echo. You kind of want to recruit a technical team member, somebody who can do the technology, because very often, mostly, the person is fairly elderly, and they're not too well up on technology.
Or find a 12-year-old.
Exactly. And the best people, the really, really the best people, very often are the grandchildren. They're fantastic for it, because the grandchildren will know all about the latest bit of kit, and if they can talk very slowly and keep repeating to their grandparent what needs to be done, then they can be extremely good. And it's great actually for the person, for their grandchildren to be there, because they love it. Exactly, it's fantastic. They loved how the grandchildren are there, and they don't get as irritated with the grandchildren as they do with the children. So that's one person that you need on the team. You need a technical person. You need a transport person, because they do need help with getting about, because of their vision problems. So you need to have somebody who can kind of look after their transport needs to get them around from wherever it is they need to go, whether it's to the shops or whether it's to go to the doctor or the hospital or wherever. That's a critical kind of person. You also need somebody who will do all the paperwork and the all that kind of stuff. I'll come back to that one later, actually. One of the really key things, actually, which sounds frivolous, but is to have a social secretary.
Yeah, I want one.
But they really should have somebody who has a social secretary. And it's one of those things that gets really, really overlooked, because, oh, well, you know, the person themselves feels guilty about saying, well, I would like to go out to somewhere or other. But it's really important that they do go out, and they have to have a social life, and it shouldn't be neglected. And it's critical in actually getting them back into independence to have somebody who will actually be there and say, right, okay, once a week, once a week, what you're really aiming at is to once a week get them taken out and go to, an art class or a coffee morning or or whatever it is.
Now, my relative keeps falling because she doesn't want to use her walker. That's an issue, right? You recommend that people with macular degeneration use some kind of walking aid, whether it's a cane or a walker or something, or holding someone's arm. They shouldn't be walking by themselves.
They don't need... Well, yeah, there's a whole section in the book about how to get around with... One of the really interesting facts that, as you notice when you put those glasses on, you can't see people, you can't recognize faces.
Right.
And one of the way that, you know, you're looking at me at the moment and I'm looking at you and we're smiling or whatever, I'm raising my eyebrows and things. Last summer, I went on holiday to France. And my wife and I had breakfast one morning in a cafe. And I had a croissant and a coffee, which was very pleasant. And then we were sat outside. And then when I'd had the coffee and croissant, I went into the cafe and I had a conversation with the waiter. I walked into the waiter and this was the conversation, which was, and the waiter looked at me and went, now, I'd raised an eyebrow and he looked down and to the left. And that was the whole of the conversation. We both knew what we'd been discussing. I had raised my eyebrow, where is the toilet? He had looked down to the left, indicating it was down the stairs in the cellar. So I went to the toilet downstairs. That is an example of a non-verbal communication.
Yes, now, which somebody I'm very who's familiar lost, with.
Somebody who's lost vision can't do non-verbal communication because they can't see. So they can't. They don't know what's going on. They don't know. They wouldn't know who the waiter was. They wouldn't know if they'd winked at the right person. They wouldn't know if they'd been noticed. They can't do that. So they have to talk to people.
Yes.
And one of the key things about that is that, and one of the most difficult things is that, strangely, going back to the fact of putting those glasses on and seeing what happens, they have got vision. They have partial vision. And so they don't feel as if they're blind or partially sighted. They don't. They feel guilty about saying, "I am blind or partially sighted," because I can sort of see.
I see that.
And so they don't like to label themselves as being blind or partially sighted because they feel guilty because I can see, and also people think, well, you're walking around, you're not bumping into things, so you can't be blind.
Well, my relative always tells me, well, I'm legally blind according to so-and-so, so I don't know what legally blind means. Do you know what legally blind means?
That's exactly it. It has a specific definition which is used by professions, but it's not what the public know and it's not what the public understand. Now, the way around that, which is a long-winded way of getting there, is that people with macular degeneration should use a white cane. But there's a lot of confusion here. People think, oh, I need a white cane or a white stick to get around with. A person with macular degeneration does not need a white cane to get about. They can get about perfectly happily without a white cane. They're not going to fall over. They're not going to walk into something. The purpose of the white cane is to tell other people that they can't see. Mm-hmm. So when they go to a social event, they have these short white canes, what they call a signal cane, which you can walk in holding it in one hand. And then it indicates to people that have walked in that, oh, they can't see. Now, if you'd lost vision, you're quite likely to go to a local social event. I don't know what you might go to. But, you know, you might walk in and you walk past me and I think, blimey, I've known Dave 20 years. He's just walked straight past me. How rude. You know, he's just rude. He's, you know, phew. Because the bulk of the people won't understand that you can't recognize me.
Right.
But if you walk in with a white cane in your hand, then I'll think, ah, there's Dave. He's got a white stick in his hand. He can't recognize me. So I'll say, hello, Dave, how are you? And you go, oh, it's Paul. Basically, using a white cane stops you being rude. If you don't use a white cane, it causes chaos because people don't know what's going on.
And I get it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was talking to a lady a couple of years ago and she was saying to me she lived in the local town and she had to go to the local supermarket and she needed to get across a road, which was a very busy road. She realised she couldn't get across the road. It was like going to commit suicide. So she was stood there waiting for somebody to come along and there were a couple of teenage lads there and she thought, well, I'm not going to ask them because I'll wait for somebody else to come along. But nobody else came along. So she went up to one of these lads and she said, excuse me, could you give me a hand getting across the road? So the lad said, certainly. He said, so he took her across the road and she got across the road. She said, thank you very much, and went to go into the supermarket. And the lad said, excuse me, he said, do you want a hand getting home when you come, when you've done your shopping? And she said, well, she thought about it and she said, well, actually, yes, that would be very helpful. So she went in and did her shopping and came out. And the lad was still there and escorted her home. And she said to me, she now makes a point of asking for help. And she said, there's three reasons why I ask for help. She said, the first reason is that if I go into the supermarket and I want a can of soup, I get the right can of soup. That's number one, very critical. The second one is I've realized that if I ask the girl for help in there, she doesn't have to carry on stocking the shelves for a couple of minutes. So she's happy to stop stocking the shelves. So she's happy. But she said the third reason that I ask for people to help me, she said, is I realized that actually if I ask for help, people feel good about themselves. And I bring a lot of pleasure to the world. So in fact, asking for help is a good thing to do, and you can bring pleasure. If you don't ask for help and you don't use a white stick, all you do is cause chaos and confusion. But yeah. If you use a white stick, it helps and people enjoy it. So you can bring a lot of pleasure to the world by using and asking for help. But people are very uncertain about that at the moment. If they don't know what's going on, as I said, they feel guilty about using a white stick, and they shouldn't. They really, really shouldn't.
Now, before you mentioned that that people with macular degeneration aren't going to fall, they don't need the stick to fall, but what about my relative who keeps falling? She needs a walker. What determines how much vision is lost where you need help walking?
Every case is different, so it's very difficult to make sweeping generalizations. But having said that, there's normally something else going on other than macular degeneration that would tend to cause that.
So theoretically, someone with macular degeneration should not need any help walking if they only have macular degeneration, nothing else, all things being equal.
Yeah, that again is a slightly difficult one because they sort of do need help. If you imagine going back to those glasses that you put on, all right, if you decided that you were going to walk around your local neighborhood, when you were a child, you learnt your neighborhood and town and so on by going walking with your mother. And you'd have walked along holding your mother's hand, and she'd have walked you to the shops or to the library or to the doctors or wherever it was you were going to go, the school, and you would have learnt where everything was. And that was how you learnt it, by walking around with your mother. Now, the person with macular degeneration has probably been living in their neighborhood for a long period of time, so they know their neighborhood, but suddenly their vision isn't very good. So theoretically, there's no reason why they shouldn't walk around their neighborhood. However, the problem is they have a map in their head of their neighborhood, but the map that they have is a visual map of their neighborhood. Okay. When you lose your vision, you need a slightly different map. You need a tactile map. So what you need to do with the person is take them out. So in fact, it's strange. It's a reversal of role. The mother will now go out with the daughter, holding the daughter's hand, and the daughter will do for her mother what the mother did for the daughter, which the daughter will go out and take them out and relearn that neighborhood. But learning where the steps are, where the trip hazards are, where the curbs are, and anything like that, so they can relearn a map. And you do it route by route, bit by bit, exactly the same as you did with your child. The child now does for you, and you learn it. You build up your neighborhood back again into a tactile map, so that you then have a map that you can go out. So the person now knows they can go out on their own quite happily because they have this tactile map in their head rather than a visual map in their head.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's time for another break, and then we're going to have to wrap it up. We've got about 5 more minutes after the break, so don't go away. We'll be right back.
Dave Nassani, the Caregiver's Caregiver, has just released his 6th book entitled It's My Life Too. Reclaim your caregiver sanity by learning when to say yes and when to say no. It was specifically written for caregivers who know they should be putting their needs first, but just don't know how. Dave is the sole caregiver to his wife, Charlene, since 1996. He knows firsthand what caregivers are going through, because he is one. And he now speaks all across the country, offering caregivers his incredible caregiver support package. Even the airlines tell us that in the event of an emergency, to put your oxygen mask on first before you help your child with their mask. They know that those who don't heed their advice often black out, thus becoming unable to help either themselves or their child. And caregivers are exactly the same way. It's my life too. Reclaim your caregiver sanity by learning when to say yes and when to say no. We'll help caregivers who are neglecting their sleep, diet, and social life, and learn to put their needs first. Pick up your copy today, or buy one for your special caregiver. On sale everywhere, and at caregiverscaregiver.com.
And we're back with Dr. Paul Wallace. They call you doctor, don't they?
No.
Well, forget that then. We're back with Paul Wallace. And Dave Nassani and Linda Bice, and we're talking about macular degeneration. So in the last 5 minutes, Paul, why don't you tell us what you haven't mentioned yet that you would like to about macular degeneration and caregivers in general, and then how someone can get a hold of you, how someone can buy their book, all of that.
Now, when somebody loses vision, you kind of expect a fairy godmother to appear on your shoulder who will point out to you exactly what you have to do. Oh, well, you go to here and they'll give you this, and this is available from so-and-so. And this person will give you counseling. This person will do this. You can get some money for that. And all these schemes are available to all sorts of things. Unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. You have to dig out all the little nuggets yourself, and it's very, very hard work. And that, again, talking about the team around you, you need to get somebody who's got grit, who is determined to get out there and actually investigate. And you need to investigate all the different things that you can do. You do it on the internet quite easily to start with. So you start at federal level, you go down to state level and then to local level, and then you do it with charities and things like that. What you find, certainly in this country, is that the provision is very sporadic. It's very random. And so you can go, you can be in one town and it'd be really, really good. There's really good charities and you go to them, they're fantastic. You can go to a town, the next town along, and it's awful. You know, the same charities are there, but they don't provide anything like the same service or whatever. So you do have to search very, very hard. Yeah. What you tend to find is that there's a kind of equilibrium almost, that if the states, provisos are not very good, then the charities tend to be quite good because they make up for it. Or if the charities aren't very good, then the states tend to be quite good. And you tend to get you can very often get what you want, but you may not get it from who you thought you were going to get it from. So I certainly would say you really do need to dig, and you've got to put your foot in the door and be assertive to make sure that you get what is available for you. Because that is really, really important. There is a lot of good stuff out there. It's just a question of finding it and digging out, finding the little nuggets of gold.
So how can someone buy your book or get a hold of you? You're going to be speaking at Harvard pretty soon, huh? I heard.
I might well be, I think, yes.
Harvard University.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. The book will be available on all good websites. It's not actually available for another 2 days. It comes out on Thursday. The problem with the book is that the person who needs the book can't read it.
Unless you have an audio version.
Well, the strap line for the book is actually the book they need but can no longer read. And because of that, I produced a separate audio book, which is purely for the person themselves who's got macular degeneration, that they can listen to. And it's slightly different because I don't need to explain to them what it's like to lose vision because they've lost it. But I had to put those explanations in for the family because they don't understand what's happening. So there's a distinct difference between the two things, where one is distinctly for the person who has lost vision, which is the audio version, and then the book itself is for the family.
Well, you are a very compassionate person toward the blind. I can certainly see that. And we thank your grandmother, or was it your great aunt?
My great aunt.
Your great.
It's interesting.
Your great great aunt, not your great great aunt, but your great great aunt.
The thing is that the thing I didn't give to that old lady on that first day, I didn't give her any hope.
Well, and, hopefully she can hear what you're saying now, and maybe she'll get.
Yeah,
some hope.
And I the book, as I said, is my penance in a way for not giving hope to that lady the one day, because I think that the book actually should give hope to people who have lost vision, because I really do believe that actually you can come to live with it, and. It's not pleasant, but you can live a life of independence and fulfilling. So, yeah.
Awesome. And you have a website, perhaps?
Yep. livingwithamd.co.uk. AMD is age-related macular degeneration. So it's livingwithamd.co.uk.
Very good. And then Linda Bice. Linda is still grieving. We're going to do a show on the grief process with you, Linda, when you're ready. Let me know. She just recently lost her husband. And
Sorry.
She looks pretty good for someone who's grieving. So how do we get a hold of you, Linda?
It's the sleep that I'm getting
now, sleep.
Unfortunately.
Yes, it's always the sleep.
Bittersweet, yeah. We have a website. It's www.bicefamily.weebly, W-E-E-B as in boy, L-Y.com, and also email at thebicefamily@gmail.com.
Bice is spelled?
B-Y-C-E.
That's good. Well, thank you both for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And thank you, Linda, for dropping what you were doing, because Adrian couldn't make it. She had to go to physical therapy. And we will see you again next week, same time, same channel. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Show. Make sure you tune in every Wednesday at noon Pacific Time and anytime afterwards on podcast to catch more of Dave and his tips to caregivers on avoiding burnout and surviving the grief process right here on the Worldwide Block Talk Radio Network. Goodbye.